twin had been 5 years earlier, when tragedy struck. It was one reason Oren had taken him onto his maintenance crew. Jabe was a sunny presence. But Oren knew what awaited the kid at home. "Boy, when your mother finds out I let you go out with the posse, they'll need to make room for me on the pyre beside the Tuscans." Vika opened the maintenance hatch on her sporty land speeder. "You want to hide back here, runt? You'll just fit." Jay blushed at the teasing.
"It won't be that bad," he said.
"Oh, yes, it will."
Oren stared at the kid. "You'll be begging the Jawas to adopt you." He stepped forward and clapped his hands twice loudly.
"That's it, people. Good job here. Back to the Oasis. Drinks at Danar's claim."
Chapter 3. The old Nikto woman plopped a bolt of cloth on the counter.
"Do you work here?"
Standing behind the counter, Annalene Calwell didn't look up from her datapad. "No, I come in here and do inventory in my spare time." A moment passed before Annalene suddenly froze.
"Wait,"
she said, eyes widening as she took in her surroundings.
"Counter cashbox title deed."
With a look of alarm, Annalene turned abruptly to the alabaster-skinned customer.
"I'm sorry. I guess I do work here."
It was a game they'd played every day since Herbalee Napti's first visit to the store. Except that, for the Nikto woman, it wasn't a game. Herbalee had never once remembered who Annalene was. For a while, Annalene had thought the alien simply couldn't distinguish among humans. Eventually, she figured out that Herbalee just didn't care. And so their game began. That had been 11 standard years ago. The shrivel-faced alien clicked her tongue with impatience.
"Now, see this?"
Her withered white finger jabbed at the fabric.
"Do you know why this costs so much?"
"No,"
Annalene said, smiling primly.
"Why?"
The Nikto's cracked lips pursed. She started to say something more, but Annalene stopped her.
"Just a second. They need me in the cantina."
Her apron whirled as Annalene spun and walked the meter and a half to where her sundries counter turned into a bar. She picked up a glass that a sleeping prospector had knocked over and then returned to Herbalee.
"I'm back," she said.
The Nikto woman tapped her foot.
"Is there someone else here I can talk to?"
"Now there, I can help you," Annalene said. After setting the glass in a basin, she stepped out through a gap in the long counter and walked to one of the back tables, where a green-snouted Rodian huddled silently over his morning calf. Annalene clapped her hand on his shoulder, an act that he seemed not to notice in the least.
"This is Bomer," she said.
Herbalee studied him.
"Does he work here?"
"We don't know," Annalene said.
"But he's here an awful lot."
"Thank you just the same."
The elderly Nikto sniffed disdainfully and headed for the front door. Annalene picked up the bolt of cloth from the counter and called after her.
"I'll set this aside for when you're here tomorrow, Herbalee. Have a nice day."
Herbalee said nothing as she stormed past Lily Pace, Annalene's best friend, who was preparing a parcel for mailing, another of the store's many services. The crimson-skinned Zeltron lapped heartily as the Nikto slammed the door behind her.
"That's our Annie,"
Lily said.
"Retailer of the year. Customers can't stay away."
"Sure they can, Lily." Annalene orbited one of the luncheonette tables, cleaning it off without looking at it.
"See, Danner had it figured. Anyone can stay away for a while, until they remember that it's 30 kilometers to the nearest working keg. Then, they never want to leave."
"I've noticed,"
Lily said, stacking packages.
"That was shorter than your usual go-around with Herbalee." Something biting you?
No. Carting the breakfast dishes behind the counter, Annalene knew that wasn't true. But what she told her friend about Danar's claim certainly was. The place was the largest facility of any kind in the Pika Oasis. Two of the domes had been there since before anyone could remember, part of some ancient farm. Annalene's late husband, Danar, had added on, connecting one of the domes with a new oblong sales area beneath a rounded roof. The dome behind now constituted her family's living quarters and guesthouse. The main building had been Annalene's domain for the majority of her 37 years, and in that time, she'd crammed an amount of commerce that defied all geometry into the limited space. Visitors encountered rows of shelves as they entered, all angled so Annalene could see down the aisles from behind her counter, which ran nearly the length of the eastern wall. But most patrons usually headed past the sundries for the rear of the main room. There, near where the far end of Annalene's counter terminated in a bar, a food preparation area sat close to 8 cramped dining tables. Every day, Annalene fed and fortified half the workers living near the oasis, not necessarily in that order. This was her roost, but the complex went on from there. Northwest of the main store was the first garage Danar had built to service the vehicles of Oasis prospectors. It had been expanded many times since, as local mechanics rented bays. To the north and east sat a livestock area, where the few surviving animals from Annalene's father's failed ranch had formed the basis for a thriving livery, serving those daring fools who preferred the reptilian dewbacks to land speeders. And all around, the oasis, a wide clearing shielded from the wind by gently rolling sandhills. Once a basin for a prehistoric lake, the area and its clumpy soil gave rise to flowering pika plants and a few hardy deb-deb trees. And something else. Orin Galt's newfangled cylindrical vaporators rose all around, producing water for delivery in the vast tankers that sat parked outside the claim's garages. Most of the harvest was bound for faraway parts. The locals drank what they needed and little more. They knew what they had and its value. Though gifted at water prospecting, Danar had never taken much interest in moisture farming. He'd reasoned that a store would weather the bad harvest years better, and that had mostly turned out to be true. But he'd left his widow with so many secondary businesses under one roof that Annalene feared taking a day off, lest Tatooine's rural economy collapse. She'd held up okay, or so she thought every once in a while, when she caught her reflection in the glassware in the sink. Annalene could even recognize herself on occasion. The auburn hair of her youth, which she wore tied back, was going to brown, not gray. So far, so good. Inside work had never fully met with her approval, but it had kept her skin rosy rather than roasted. And Annalene's eyes were about the only true green thing on the whole planet, if you didn't count dewbacks or Rhodian barflies. Counting dewbacks was now her daughter's job anyway. Looking out the square window, Annalene could see Callie, blonde and determined, trying to teach the dewback yearlings some manners before they realized they had the muscle to tear the fencing apart at will. At least, Callie wasn't messing with Snit, Annalene saw to her relief. The creature wasn't of the cannibal breed. Annalene wouldn't have let one of those near the compound, but Snit had been bitten by a creature as a hatchling and had been snapping at everything in sight since. Annalene assumed her daughter had the sense to stay away, but she never knew. Breaking dewbacks wasn't a safe job for an assassin droid, much less a 17-year-old girl. But Danar Calwell had never accepted limits, and his oldest child wasn't about to either. Stubbornness bred true. Annalene had hoped her son Jabe would be different. But it wasn't turning out that way. And between the emergency siren, her kids, and the customers today, Annalene had just about had it. She glared out the window and winced. In pain.
Ow!
That's new, Lily said, depositing her parcel and some credits on the counter. She pointed to Annalene's hands.
You have literally cut off your own circulation with your apron strings. Appropriate.
A little on the nose, though.
Looking down, Annalene quickly unwound the fabric from her reddened palm. You're the range psychiatrist now?
No, but I've got 5 children of my own. And I know if you keep staring at Callie and those animals, she's just gonna try to ride the crazy one.
Annalene turned away from the window. Now that's where you're wrong, she said, collecting the money.
It's always the kid I can't see that I'm worried about.
Jabe had already been long gone with the prospectors when the settler's call had sounded. Her son knew very well that Annalene thought about him getting anywhere near Oren's business. But as far as she could tell, the boy didn't care at all. She just didn't understand him anymore. Jabe had something everyone on Tatooine dreamed of. A guaranteed life of safe indoor work, filling his father's shoes. Instead, the stubborn teen kept sneaking away with Oren's work crew. Sure, Annalene knew the boy had eyes for Oren's daughter, Vika. But he had no more chance with that hellion than he had of becoming Chancellor of the Republic, or whatever they called it these days. No, Annalene concluded. He'd gone with the crew this morning in retaliation for having been made to clean the cookers before dawn. And if he followed them into danger, that'd be spite too. That irritated her beyond measure. Spite was stupid. Even Callie was too smart to write snit just to make a point. And Annalene had always figured Jabe had sense, her sense. He'd give the Tuskins the same berth, wouldn't he? She was afraid she knew the answer. She found her inventory data pad and returned to staring at it. She couldn't read a word, of course. She only saw Jabe. And Oren. Oren. The claim had thrived long after Danar's death because Annalene had one steadfast rule. She never let anyone have anything on account. There was only one exception. Oren. Danar's best friend and sometimes business partner. Oren and Danar's friendship had gone back years, long before Annalene had come to work at Danar's store as a teenager. The two men had so many side deals that she'd always felt awkward trying to set limits. But Oren was sorely testing her patience now, dangling the possibility of range work for her son. Oren's family was a mess. Why did he meddle with hers? Aggravated, she tried to focus again on the data pad.
You're holding it upside down,
Lily said from behind. Annalene didn't look up.
Are you still here? I'm waiting for my change.
You're out of luck. Change is the one thing Tatooine doesn't have.
Taking a deep breath, she looked back at Lily and smiled wanly.
How much was it?
Lily waved her hand.
Keep it. Maybe you can pay Dr. Mel to give you something to help you relax.
Yeah,
Annalene said. Like a ticket to Alderaan. As if Lily's words had summoned him, the local physician, a Mon Calamari man, popped his head in the side door.
Annalene, are they back yet?
Mel wore a special cowl, supplying his tendrilled head with moisture, but he was flushed red nonetheless.
The posse! I heard the call go off.
They heard it on Sir Urja, Doc, Annalene said. And Sir Urjans don't have ears. She didn't know if Mon Calamari had ears either, but she knew Doc Mel wouldn't mind the joke. The call was a gaudy display of decibels. Half the breakables in the store had fallen to the first test of the system years earlier. Annalene had learned to tune it out, a talent perfected during a lifetime in retail.
They still might need a medic. I should meet them on the way back,
the doctor said, before cracking the door and pushing his young son inside. Annalene started.
Hey, wait, don't leave your kid here.
I'll be back.
The door slammed. Annalene pitched the data pad over her shoulder and felt her forehead. Yes, she was still here. And so were the four other younglings that had already been dropped off when their parents left with the posse. Two were at a table eating food plucked from the shelf. Two more were hiding somewhere. Babysitting wasn't her job, but with people rushing out to help someone in need, she'd found it hard to argue. Except people frequently left their children when there was no emergency too. Annalene looked down on the sniffling pink ragamuffin and rolled her eyes. She sighed.
Oh,
all right. She took the boy by the shoulders and pointed him to a rack near the wall. Take a broom, kid. And nothing else.
Yes, ma'am.
The child began to dutifully sweep the floor near the table where the other children were sitting. From inside the front door, Lily laughed.
Good luck, Annie.
Annalene scowled playfully. Just go. You're letting the tepid air out. A low whine sounded from the west, slowly increasing in volume and crescendo. Annalene dashed to the counter to check the video feed from the Southern Hillside security cam. She saw what she expected to see. Land speeders coming back from the Vizard farm. And she also saw what she had feared to see. Jabe, perched precariously on the back of Vika Galt's snazzy landspeeder. Annalene opened the window and called out to her daughter.
Callie, bring me a bantha prod.
The girl looked up from her work.
You want the training prod or the big one?
Dark eyebrows made an angry V. Doesn't matter.
Chapter 4.
For Orin, returning to the claim was always like coming home. It wasn't his home, of course. It was Danar's. And then Danar's and Annalene's. And for the last several years, Annalene's alone. But Orin felt the tie to the compound that went beyond the law, or such law as there was on Tatooine. Orin had laid the first bricks for the store, driven in the first landspeeder for repair, and eaten the first meal at the lunch counter. A place was a thing, and you weren't supposed to get sentimental about things, but it was also his last link to the best friend he'd ever had, and that wasn't something he'd ever be able to ignore. The claim had been Danar's big idea. He was good with ideas, even better than Orin was. Together, they'd made great things happen in the Oasis. One day, they'd imagined, Orin's farms and Danar's market would turn into a second Anchorhead, or even Bastine. Orin could see that happening. The Pika had that much potential. But Danar had changed after marrying his sales clerk. He'd always kept a foot in the store after that, never willing to risk more than he could afford at one time. And after Callie was born, forget it. Fatherhood had the opposite effect on Orin. He couldn't wait to hit the range each day, searching for treasure in the air. But Danar's bets were ever smaller, and on surer things. That had made Danar's claim a strong operation, to be sure, a good earner, even by Orin's current standards. But it had meant that only one of them was able to go for the main chance when opportunity came. By the time Jabe was in the cradle, Orin's holdings had almost completely enveloped the store property. Not that Danar had ever begrudged Orin's success. Danar had been happy to see someone making use of his ideas, and the fact that it was a friend profiting made it even better. The Calwell and Galt operations were as close as they could be without a legal partnership, which the friends never contemplated, given their mutual contempt for the legal clerks in Bastine. No tax collector had any right to either man's work. And if Orin wanted to store his vaporator construction speeders in Danar's garages, or if Danar wanted to arrange his dewbacks on Orin's land, well, they didn't need a document for that. The policy had continued under Annalene, more or less, in the nearly 8 years since Danar passed. The claimed spare garages now held the entire Galt work fleet. And when Orin took administrative control of the settlers' call fund he had co-founded with his neighbors, it made perfect sense that the claim should serve as its operational base. The facility had plenty of room to house the emergency response vehicles owned by the fund. And if the responders needed an arsenal, they only had to walk next door to find Annalene's gun racks. There was one more thing the claim had to offer, Orin knew. The reward for a dangerous job well done. As manager of the call fund, Orin had seen the need and made the provision long ago, and no one had ever argued. His was a vigilante organization with a liquor tab.
Good stuff here, folks!
Orin climbed out of his prized USV-5 landspeeder and slapped the hood. The other vehicles were arriving one by one.
Park the loners by the garage. We'll take care of them. And you can drink your fill before the lunch rush!
A cheer rose from the growing crowd. Some quickly headed into Danner's claim, but more lingered outside, sharing their stories and trophies. Reminded, Orin reached into the landspeeder to find his new gaffy stick, or gadurfi, or whatever the savages call the bizarre hunks of metal. The young Tuscan cut to pieces in the crossfire had carried this one. Now, with one boot on the bobbing hood of his parked hovercraft, Orin hoisted the weapon over his head. He gave a war whoop and smiled broadly. Another cheer went up.
Let's hear it for the King of the Jundland!
Orin's head snapped back at the sound of the feminine voice. Vika was there, having parked her vehicle behind the others. Young Jabe and a couple of other settlers' kids were piling off the back of the speeder, rifles in hand. Vika grinned at her father and shouted again,
Hail to the King!
Don't call me that,
Orin growled. He hated the name, and Vika knew better than to use it. But he heard it again from here and there in the swelling crowd.
All hail! King of the Jundland!
No, no, don't do that,
Orin said. He laughed, loudly enough so they could hear him. He knew not to take it seriously. These people weren't looking for a ruler. It was why half of them were on Tatooine. They needed to know he knew that too. Orin leaned the gadurfi against the hood of his landspeeder and raised his hands in humility. It's a team effort, he said, quieting the crowd.
Always. You folks. You saved that farm.
His voice rose.
And never, ever forget why we're doing this. Remember the people that the Tuscans have killed for no reason at all. People who were just trying to make an honest living. Farmer after farmer. We've lost more prospecting knowledge than we can ever appreciate. It's why we all came together to set up the Settlers' Call years ago. To help us take back our lives.
He pointed to a tall vaporator tower, rising from the slope to the south of the store.
Up there on top is the very first siren, erected on Danar Cowell's old number one vaporator.
Some of you new folks didn't know Danar, but he was the best friend a man and this oasis could have. The Tuscans took him from us too. But the siren remains, one of many. That's part of his legacy to us. Danar's gone, but the call still goes out. And it's our job to answer it.
Orin softened his voice. That's the key, folks. I know you're not fighters. I know you have your own field you should be working right now. And it's not always easy to find the extra credits that keep the settlers' call going.
I've sure put plenty into it myself, and not just money.
He choked up for a moment and paused to clear his throat. But that's just it. Many of you know my younger son died a few years ago, answering the call. He did it to save a neighbor. There's not a day that I don't miss him. But I don't regret at all what he went to do. A community's a living thing. And our actions together keep it alive. Oren looked up. The settlers were watching him spellbound, as usual.
That's all, he said, breaking the solemnity. And before you drink up, a reminder. Any of you who haven't paid your subscription for the season, the Settlers' Call Fund office is in the back, behind the secondhand clothing. You might need us at your place one day. These speeders don't run on goodwill.
Oren smiled as several of the posse members rushed to shake his hand. He glanced up at the climbing suns. His crews had lost most of the morning in the fields, but this was important too. Without camaraderie, there was no community. The oxygen that the settlers' call needed to function. Subscriptions always went up after a Tuscan attack, but that was nothing compared with what happened after a successful defense and retaliation. He nodded to Mullen, who opened the door to the store for the settlers. Anna Lean stormed through it, nearly knocking Mullen down. Oren spotted something long and black in her hands a second before she found her son in the crowd. Jabe, in the middle of being ribbed by Vika about something, looked back at Anna Lean, startled. Mom, A golden electric flash struck the ground not far from the teenager's feet. Startled, the boy jumped backward, tripping over his boots and landing on his rear. Mullen and Oren stood back.
Yikes,
Mullen said. Oren nodded.
Yep.
Jabe looked up from the sand to see his mother holding a bantha prod.
What the?
Realizing what had happened, his immediate reaction was incredulity.
You almost shocked me!
Oh, did I miss?
Anna Lean snarled.
Maybe I should try again. Mom!
Behind Oren, Callie appeared in the store doorway holding a shorter staff.
Mom, do you want to switch to the training prod?
This is training him just fine,
Annaline growled. Taking a breath, she looked at the bantha prod for a moment before rolling her eyes and tossing it away. She turned and loomed over Jabe.
Now you listen to me.
You did not have my permission to skip out on the breakfast prep. You did not have permission to go working in the suns with these roughnecks.
Her voice climbed.
And you sure as blazes don't have my permission to go out with the posse!
Jabe coughed, more embarrassed than hurt.
Mom, people were in danger. You were in danger.
Smirking, Oren gestured to the amused vigilantes who had forgotten about the free spirits.
A wide berth, gentle creatures, if you please. Annaline Caldwell is parenting again.
Hearing his voice, Annaline turned abruptly and sputtered.
And you!
Oren outweighed his best friend's widow by 30 kilos. And yet, as she started toward him, he took a step backward. Self-preservation came before public image. Spying the Gaderfi resting against the hood of his landspeeder, he playfully picked it up and held it with both hands, in simulated defense. But Annaline kept coming.
Easy there, he said.
She grabbed at the midsection of the Gaderfi and used it to pull him toward her.
I'm telling you for the last time, Oren, if you ever let Jabe go out on one of your posses again, you better wrap your head in bandages and stay with the Tuscans. Now, Annie, don't you now Annie me,
she cut in, livid.
I mean it, Oren.
You can get your speeders out of my garages and park them under a tarp, she said, pushing at the gaffy stick. You want somebody to feed your crew? You go to Bestine.
You want guns? You talk to Jabba.
Hey now, Warren said defensively, aware again of the rapt crowd. Even the drinkers had come out of the claim to watch. This isn't some eastern town. This is the Peak Oasis. Nobody here messes with Java.
You cross me again, and you'll feel like a hut landed on you. Green eyes blazed at him.
Understood?
You get the wildest ideas. Now calm down, or you'll leave your boy an orphan.
With a heave, Orin tugged at the weapon. He expected resistance,
but she let go suddenly, and his arm, overbalanced, swung the Gaderfi in a wide arc right into the windshield of his landspeeder. Shards flew everywhere.
Orin eyed the mess. Great, he said. Just great. He looked back at Annalene.
See what you made me do?
Me? You were holding it. Annalene barely glanced at the shattered windshield.
I hope you took a lot better care of my son out there.
Jabe takes care of himself just fine, Warren said, growing aggravated.
You're treating him like a droid with a restraining bolt.
Oh, really? Really? He and Annalene were in each other's faces now.
And maybe you should look at yourself, Warren said.
Ask yourself just why he feels the need to get out from under. A husky voice came from the crowd.
Just kiss her already.
Who said that? Annalene's eyes darted around the spectators.
Who said that?
We all did,
Lily said, crossing her arms and shaking her head. Annalene snorted at her friend.
I thought you left.
What, and missed the entertainment?
The settlers to either side of the Zeltron laughed. While Annalene smoldered, Orin quickly passed the Tusken weapon to his son. Half the Oasis had been trying to set Annalene up with Orin since his last wife left. The other half assumed they were already together. But Orin knew better than to react in the slightest. There wasn't a more dangerous subject in the galaxy. Annalene pivoted and returned to her son. Callie was helping him stand. He seemed flustered and a little tipsy to Orin, but undamaged.
Lily's right, Mom, the farmer heard Callie whisper. You and Orin have been doing this dance for years.
You can be replaced, Annalene told her daughter, ire returning. Go do something. Callie looked at her, offended.
Okay.
She turned on her heel and left, abandoning Jabe, who immediately fell back to the ground. As Annalene collected her son, Orin directed Mullen to take his landspeeder back to the garage. It's no big deal. Just have Glomer put the repair on the account, he said, remembering some of the debts he had coming due. Orin lowered his voice and added to Mullen, the store's account. The show over, the crowd filtered into the claim. Annalene brushed herself off. She would have a lot of people to serve. Orin chanced a conversation with her before he followed the others. Did you get the bazaars put up? Annalene expelled a deep breath.
They're in the guest quarters now. They came in just as I was heading out to meet Jabe.
Blessed reason. I hope you at least put down the bantha prod, Orin said.
Those people have been scared enough.
Orin watched as Annalene tried and failed to suppress a smile.
No, she said. They're okay. The doc's in with them.
That's good. Before he could enter the store, Annalene pulled at his sleeve and looked at him with concern.
They said it was Plug-Eye.
Orin spoke softly.
Yeah, they got old Lotho and the Bith farmhand, but we took out a few.
He paused. Our people didn't chase far. She stared keenly at him.
And Jabe was never in danger? Everyone lives with danger here, you know that. But if you try to turn that boy into a clerk like his daddy, you're gonna lose him altogether. You need to trust me.
Orin tapped her on the shoulder. Now, if both your children are accounted for,
I think we've got about 30 heroes waiting for their drinks in there.
On the funds tab, she said, with what he took for mock sternness. Then she nearly smiled.
Yes, we'll be all right.
Orin grinned as he held the door open for her. This would turn out to be a good day after... A loud crack resonated from the other side of the building, followed by a feral yelp. A young woman's indecipherable yell came a second later.
Now what?
Puzzled, Orin rounded the building. There, in the side yard, he saw smashed corral fencing and a cloud of dust heading toward the dunes to the southwest. He could just make out the blonde figure amid the whirlwind, hanging on for dear life. Annalene appeared beside him. Tell me it isn't.
Can't lie to you,
Orin said, peering into the distance.
That would be your Callie, running off on a crazy dewback.
Snit!
Orin sighed and shrugged.
Well, you did tell her to go do something.
Chapter 5. Ayak jabbed the knife again into the warrior's arm. Black streamed from the cut, fouling the young Tuscan's wrappings. The shrapnel was buried deep, too deep for Ayak to reach. The survivors of the raiding party had been glad to reach the pillars, a jagged cleave into the Jundland, where the settlers and their vehicles could not follow. But the wastes had taken offense at being used for cowardice, and the young Tuscan had paid. The injured warrior had evaded the settlers' gunfire, but not the accursed grenade they had thrown before leaving, and what it had done to the rock wall. The arm would grow diseased, the hand unusable. If something happened beyond that, the Tuscans never knew. It wasn't a thing worth knowing. Ayak gave the blade to the warrior and spoke the words. They were the words known to all of them, the words that separated a Tuscan from the other creatures that lived in the dust.
Whoever has two hands can hold a Gaderfi.
The warrior stared at the weapon but did not question his duty. Another would take his bantha. The band could no longer afford to lose warrior and beast both. Ayak gave the warrior his solitude and made a mental note to send someone over for the body. The important work was with the others now. The morning's raid had been a risk, perhaps too great a risk when their numbers were so small. And yet, Ayak had been certain that it was necessary. The settlers had grown too bold. The Tuscans needed to be bolder. What remained of the clan now hid, like the coward sun among the pillars. Legend held that a giant had repeatedly struck the mountains with a dagger here. Some said it was the younger son himself, flailing against his brother. Whatever the explanation, the landscape was unreal. Natural stone columns and crumbling obelisks climbed to the sky, some topped by precariously perched boulders. A maze of narrow passageways crisscrossed among the towers. Some led to caverns, some led nowhere. A clearing amid the tall rocks provided enough room for a cramped campground around a sacred well. Banthas and sand people alike clumped in the craggy stomach of the Jundland. No one said anything as Ayak passed through the camp. The dozens who had remained here during the raid knew that many weaklings had fallen. There was no time to mourn the unworthiness of kin. Those names, those voices belonged to the past. The sand people had to survive today. The Tuscans had a word for tomorrow, but it was seldom used. What good would it be? Death rode behind the Tuscan as the shadows to the Bantha. The settlers seemed not to know that. Erecting shelters to protect their precious futures, the settlers became things fat and fleshy, no better than huts. Perhaps that was how the huts had come to be. Ayak had never really wondered about it, or much else. No, only today mattered. Each day's survival was a trophy that could be carried into the tales of the past. a stroke against the damnation cast upon them by the suns. It was a thing to be proud of. But who would tell the stories if all fell? At the well, the thirsty war leader dismissed the idle thoughts and pulled the rope. The noons were coming. Younglings needed feeding. Gaderfi Point sharpening. And a new target would need to be chosen. A Yark would select it, as always. The container reached the top of the well. For the third time in as many days, it held only damp sand. Others had called it an ill omen. A Yark simply wanted to kill something. A cloth-bound youngling ran up and bleated a message from the watch. A Yark listened with rising anger. There was someone riding an animal through the dunes. Again. There had been other encroachments near the wastes recently. A Yark had even heard of a single hooded human riding a heavily laden Eope across the desert from east to west, untouched by the Tuscan scouts who espied him. A Yark had flown into a rage over that one. A settler might take a machine across the dunes, or attempt to, but this was the act of one whose wits were lost, or of a being so powerful he felt none could harm him. A Yark didn't care what the answer was. Such impudence should have been dealt with, no matter what their current state. The others hearing the youngling took up their weapons right away. Good, a Yark thought. Even after this morning, some spirit remained. But much needed doing here. They would stay while a Yark went to investigate and punish the intruder. And if they argued the point, someone else would lose an arm. This kill would belong to a Yark.
Yah!
Annalene yanked again at the reins. Vilas heard and rumbled forward, nimbly crawling over the rocky outcrop. He was over it in a few seconds. Another call from Annalene and he was off again, barreling across the floor of the dusty Bowl Valley. Kicks from a rider meant nothing to the dewback, whose brownish-red scales could protect it against any spur. But Vila seemed to understand where he was going and what he had to do. It was why Annalene had headed directly for him when she'd seen the busted fence. Her landspeeder would have been faster, but Callie and Snit had lit off in the direction of the Rumbles, a lightly rocky stretch known mostly for the turbulent ride it gave hovercraft. That was no problem, but it also made for more difficult tracking at speed. Vilas, on the other hand, knew right where to go, she hoped.
That's the one, she said, picking out the right cloud from several dust devils in the distance.
Vilas knew it too. She clung to him. Annalene hadn't ridden in 3 years, but it wasn't something she was likely to forget. Half the dewbacks in Bastine today had descended from Calum Thaney's herd. She'd be working on her father's ranch still if the animals hadn't gotten the parch, a wasting disease that prevented their cells from utilizing water. By the end, there had been little left of the herd, or of Calum, who'd watched as all his farmhands left. After Annalene was forced to take a job working for Danar, her father became unreachable. 4 years later, after she and her mother relocated to a hut nearer the oasis, he finally took a blaster to his sorrows. Annalene had found him at home just 3 days after her announced engagement. He'd relocated the dozen remaining dewback eggs to what had once been her nursery years before. The livery stables and corral of the claim had been Danar's surprise wedding present to Annalene. The Thaney legacy lived on outside her store window, providing her distraction and solace. And when Danar had died, Callie, then 9, had found that same peace in tending the creatures. Annalene had ceded all care of the animals to her then. Callie needed it. And there was something else. The girl wouldn't have to spend her teen years debating the price of blankets with people who couldn't remember her name. It felt good to be on a dewback again, though, even given the danger. Snit had been a temptation, a challenge sitting there for Callie for far too long. Annalene suspected now that Snit had Mountain Dewback blood in him. One of Orin's crews had brought a batch of eggs after digging them up in the field. Mountain Dewbacks were just shy of the cannibal breed for craziness. Annalene cursed herself for not doing a proper genetic workup before. She knew how, and the stable had simple diagnostic tools. But she'd been too busy. And neither of her kids were proving much good against temptation. Callie was in sight now, half a kilometer ahead. Snit didn't show any signs of stopping. Annalene and her mount cut directly across the flats toward them. Callie was still out of earshot, but Annalene could see the girl was no longer in control of the beast, if she ever had been. The Calwell livery beat all others for safety. Three mighty girth straps went around each Dewback's midsection, securing saddles. But those only worked well if the Dewback sat still for a fitting, and she couldn't imagine Snit had. The resultant loose straps, she now saw, had caused the saddle to start sliding off Snit's back to the right. Callie, her foot tangled in a stirrup, was hanging over the animal's side, desperately clinging to the reins. With every futile attempt to climb back atop Snit, the girl was driving him crazier. He wouldn't stop until he'd shaken her. Snit topped a rise and vanished. Annalene reached it long seconds later. What she saw on the other side took her breath away. She'd known the eastern reaches were prone to sinkholes, but this place was a geologic minefield. Worse, it was the kind of pockmarked landform favored by, and often caused by, creatures so horrific they nearly defy description. Sarlaccs. Big underground appetites that preyed on anything foolish enough to wander along. Monsters that could swallow a land speeder whole, but were often impossible to see until they had you. And Snit was running straight into the place. Annalene doubled up on the reins and pushed ahead. Vila snorted, straining against her. He didn't like the look of the area, she could tell, and she couldn't blame him. But she had to play the odds. Sarlaccs were rare. There was a particularly large one at Carcoon, another near some of Tatooine's many ancient ruins she'd heard tell. Even a tiny one of their spawn could be a fatal discovery. But there was no other choice now. She prodded the animal into a bounding run, keeping as far away from the mini-craters as possible.
Help!
Annalene's eyes left the pitted ground and darted 100 meters ahead. Snit was going places fast, and Callie was still stuck.
Mom, help!
Annalene's heart caught in her throat, but she realized it meant that Callie had seen her. She gritted her teeth and pushed forward, her senses overloading. There was sand flying everywhere in Snit's wake. Annalene's hair, now unbound, blew openly and violently behind her. The desert floor rose and fell below, present here, absent there. And there was the constant thrum, thrum, thrum of Velas's feet slamming against the surface, reverberating through her body. Yet she was still gaining. Velas got his legs tangled up for a moment, but recovered quickly. Facing away from the chase for that second, Annalene thought she saw a Tusken Raider peering at her from over a far distant dune. A moment later, she was back on track and sure she was hallucinating. Too much adrenaline. Snit, up ahead, didn't seem to care about anything. Annalene's voice cracked as she yelled into the wind.
Stop! Stop!
Snit was only a dozen meters ahead of her, and Annalene could see clearly how Callie was tangled in the stirrup. The terrified girl was half sliding off Snit's right side now, and in imminent danger of shaking free and landing beneath the beast's massive rear legs. Annalene had to move.
Sorry, boy, she called to Vilas. Gotta do this!
She pushed the Dewback harder, bringing him within nipping distance of Snit's left hind shank. There was no question of riding up on the right. Callie would be doubly in danger then if she fell. and Aline would have to bring the monster under control herself. Vilas moderated his pace, fearful Aneline figured of Snit turning on him. But she was close enough. She released the reins, threw her weight forward, and scrambled up onto Vilas' massive neck, the dewback scales skinning her gloveless hands. She looked down at the narrowing space between the two dewbacks. Grit exploded from the ground, each pounding step of Snit's a sandy geyser. If Snit knew Vilas was alongside, he hadn't reacted. Yet. But he surely would. What would he do then? Aneline had mounted a trotting dewback before, but never an angry one, running at full speed from atop another animal. Snit could do anything. It was too dangerous to try. But she could hear Callie too, crying out with every bump. Now! Aneline reached into space, clutching for Snit's rearmost girth strap. It was the only part of the rigging that looked at all secure. And it was. The second she had a firm grasp on it, she heaved herself from Vilas to Snit. This Snit did notice, and he wasn't the least bit happy about it. He snapped his mighty tail forward, trying to swat away the woman hugging his back. Aneline hung on, pulling herself ahead, handhold by tenuous handhold. Vilas was gone now, having angled off to the north. Aneline was committed. Still clinging, she grabbed Callie's arm and tried to pull her up. No good. The load was too much, her hold too awkward. Aneline feared toppling them both off. But better they go on or go off the creature together. Aneline reached over to grab a handful of shirt and saw something off to the right. It appeared just at the edge of her peripheral vision. For a split second, she thought it was the imagined Tuscan. But jerking her head backward for a moment, she saw the reality was more unbelievable. Another rider had joined the chase, angling in from the faraway rise to the southeast. A figure clad in brown, racing at a diagonal to catch up with them. Running at full tilt on an Eope? Aneline looked down at Callie, whose face was frozen in terror, and then back at the newcomer. She'd seen it all right. An Eope. A fraction the size of the dewback, four-legged and tan. An Eope could sprint, but its legs were no match for those of the dewback. And yet the hooded figure guided it quickly along, with no more effort than one would exhibit driving a speeder bike. Aneline gawked. The rider couldn't possibly catch up to them, but he was certainly trying. Not all desert brigands were Tuscans, she knew, but a smart scavenger wouldn't chase anyone down in this terrain. He'd wait for the women to break their necks. Did this one actually want to help them? She wondered. He answered that himself.
Hold on!
The Eope nimbly danced along the edges of the sandpits, making no more imprint with its hooves than if it had been riderless. The man, close enough now that Aneline could make out a human nose and an auburn beard and mustache under the flapping hood, rode the creature expertly, approaching Snit without seeming regard for his own safety. Snit's tail whipped back and forth wildly, forcing the Eope rider to weave and dodge. But he continued to accelerate. A second later, he was alongside the deranged reptilian. Aneline looked ahead at the tortured terrain, worse than anything behind. Snit's massive hind feet might punch through the crusty sand and catch anywhere. When Aneline looked back, she could tell the mystery rider saw the danger too. His eyes locked with hers.
Give me the girl!
Without thinking, Aneline repositioned her arm under Callie's chest and pushed. Her daughter, unaware of the new arrival, screamed as she lost her last handhold on the reins. But less than a breath separated the Eope and the dewback now, and a long arm reached from the billowing cloak to grab her. Aneline transferred Callie's other arm to his and shoved.
Annalene slammed across the monster's back as the weight fell away. She saw Callie and the rider atop the Eopie, which was slowing now from the additional burden. No way would it carry two for long, nor three for a second. Snit was her problem. Recovering, she looked forward. It was just a matter of finding the... Snit's rear foot struck a hole. Annalene went somersaulting forward, even as the impossible mass of the dewback went aloft underneath her. She saw light as the suns flashed before her eyes, and then darkness as the bulk of the dewback eclipsed them. And then, nothing.
Chapter 6.
Mom!
Annalene opened her eyes and swiftly shut them.
I can't see. Wait,
Callie said, brushing the grains of sand from her mother's eyelashes.
Try now.
Annalene tried again. She saw a young face stained by sandal grease hovering over her, lit from above by the high suns. Annalene tried to speak, but her voice cracked.
Callie, you...
You.
It's okay, Mom. I'm okay.
You're grounded, Annalene said.
For life.
Callie grinned.
She's going to be all right.
Yes,
replied someone else.
She is.
Annalene couldn't hear where the voice was coming from, but she didn't want to sit up to look either. Not when the sand was nice and soft and warm. Callie vanished from her view, and another face replaced hers. It was the rider from before. His hood was removed now. He had reddish-blonde hair, lighter than his beard and mustache. His blue-gray eyes looked on her with what Annalene interpreted as bemusement. "Hello there," he said, in an accent she couldn't place.
"You've taken a nasty spill."
"You might be on to something,"
Annalene said, coughing. He smiled. A pleasant smile, she thought, not one of Orin's winning ones, to be sure, but understated and inflected with well-meaning, as was his voice.
"You're in one piece," he said. "You'll be picking sand out of your clothes for a while, but nothing appears broken."
The man produced a canteen from the folds of his cloak. It was an old garment, she saw, its deep brown turned tawny in places from wear. Beneath, she could see he wore a blousy tan tunic. The stranger paused as he knelt close.
"May I?"
Annalene tried to nod. He lifted her head gently so she could take a drink. Annalene drank desperately, half realizing that 17 years of her teachings about strangers in the desert were vanishing before her daughter's eyes. Annalene didn't know what to think about the newcomer, other than that he seemed to be dressed out of her seconds bin at the store. Annalene gasped as she finished swallowing. She nodded her thanks to the stranger and then narrowed her eyes.
"Callie."
The stranger stepped away and her daughter reappeared.
"Yes, Mom?"
Annalene's hand shot up, grabbing at the girl's collar.
"What were you doing?"
A guilty look crossed Callie's face.
"Well, you had half the galaxy showing up at the claim to get drunk, and before lunch even. I figured if I didn't get out and work the animals on the range, I'd be stuck in there helping."
"Yes, but why that animal?"
I don't know," Callie shrugged. "Besides, I didn't think you'd care. You were busy with Jabe, as always."
Behind the girl, the stranger fastened the lid in his canteen and chuckled.
"If you were trying to get your mother's attention, my young friend, you succeeded."
He flashed that disarming smile again. Callie's brown eyes lit up and she beamed at him.
"Oh, please, you can call me Callie."
He smiled politely and Annalene glared at her daughter.
"Grounded for life," she said and tried to sit up.
A second later, she realized the futility of the attempt and surrendered to gravity. The stranger was back down in a flash, catching her.
His riding gloves exposed his bare fingers, and she could feel them in her hair.
"Don't do anything rash," he said. "We just got you back to the world."
"Right."
With the help of the two of them, Annalene sat up.
"I was heading home from Bastine when I saw you were having troubles," he said.